8 centuries, the Cathedral of Notre Dame has been central to the life of Paris, and indeed of France. And still today, Notre Dame, built on an island, the Île de la Cité, here in the heart of the French capital, dominates the landscape. The cathedral is built in the shape of a cross. For the many who visited Notre Dame, the cathedral's most memorable feature must be the main west-facing facade. At ground level are 3 arched portals, each door surrounded by heavily sculpted stone. Above them, a row of freestanding statues stretch the width of the building. Then there is one of the famous rose-shaped windows, almost 10 meters in diameter. And finally, the 2 huge square bell towers rise from the body of the facade. So now I'm facing the cathedral with my first guide, Anne Prash, who's Professor of Medieval Art History here at the Sorbonne in Paris. Anne, how did the cathedral first come to be built?
Well, it's difficult to know exactly because we have not got many texts on the time. We knew there were very old churches here, already the Cathedral of Paris, but there were really 3 churches, one dedicated to Notre Dame, as today, another dedicated to St. Stephen, and a baptistry. And then around 1160, we don't know exactly the date, the bishop and his canons, because the canons of the cathedral were very important too, decided to rebuild the cathedral in one single and large building. And the only explanation for that is really that Paris had become a very large city at the time, and the king was becoming really the king of a great territory. Paris was really the capital of the king and of the kingdom.
So Maurice de Sully and his canons decided that a great cathedral should be erected. How would Maurice of Sully have gone about that at the time?
Maurice de Sully had probably to find the money to finance the building. And we know that the cathedral, that means the bishop and the canons, owned many farmlands and quarries and mills, all kinds of revenues around Paris. And from these revenues, they probably decided they couldn't make it. So they had to find the ground, because probably the ground of the previous churches was not enough. It's quite possible that the cathedral now extends at the east end on former cemeteries or parts of the aisle belonging to the bishop and the canons. And we know, because they started by the east end, when they wanted to build the facade in 1208, they had to demolish some houses which belonged to the hospital. And then they had to get the stones themselves. And we know from analysis of the stone that all the stone come from Paris itself, probably from the left bank, and brought near Notre Dame through the river.
So Maurice de Sully, the time when he came to build, or he instigated the building of the cathedral, he would have been a very powerful man as Bishop of Paris. What kind of power would he have had?
Well, he was powerful, yes. He was not a very important man by his family. He was from a modest family. He was important as a bishop because the bishop was at the head of all the church in what we call the diocese, the administrative district of the church. And he had his own police and his own justice. And his justice and police were sometimes so severe that the students who were studying in the school of the cathedral decided to leave the city to go on the left bank, on the territory of the Abbey of Sainte-Geneviève, because the Abbey of Sainte-Geneviève was independent from the justice of the bishop. And then it is the way the University of Paris started. But it means that the bishop was really a powerful man.
In the 12th century, the Île de la Cité was divided between the palace and the church. The west side housed King Louis VII, and the east side was owned by the bishop and his canons. And when Notre Dame was started, a new road had to be built to get all the materials in place. The name of the initial architect isn't known, although it's certain that he wouldn't have lived to see the completion of his masterpiece, as the cathedral took more than 50 years to complete. 8 centuries ago, this square where I'm standing, facing the glorious western facade of Notre Dame, would have been a tangle of medieval streets. Today, I'm surrounded by souvenir vendors and thousands of tourists. And I've just met Peter and Oriel Kane, a husband and wife team of tour guides who are going to look at much of the cathedral with me.
So here we're really in the heart of Paris, aren't we? There's sort of tourists everywhere. This is the Île de la Cité. But this has a relevance to anybody who's travelling, whether by car or on foot.
Yes, because all distances are measured from this little spot here in front of Notre Dame for all the roads of France. So if you happen to be in Versailles or somewhere, it will say 14 kilometres to Notre Dame.
Many people like to stand on this spot and look at the facade of the cathedral and make a wish.
Oh, I'm standing on it. Does that mean I should make a wish? I should make a wish.
Be very careful about the wish you make, because I stood on this spot and made a wish, and, well, I've been married for 3 years now, so just think very carefully before you make your wish.
Right, so we're looking at the grand facade, and it's quite extraordinary. There are statues, there are sculptures everywhere.
Yes, and the reason why it's sculpted is that these were teaching sculptures because people couldn't read or write, so they would have known the Bible stories by looking at these sculptures. It's like a Bible in stone.
So what I'm actually looking at are 3 large doors in front of me, huge doors that come up to an arch at the top, and they're covered in sculptures. And above them, there's a row that covers the whole length of the building of double life-sized sculptures of people, saints, I imagine.
Kings, in fact. They're supposed to be the kings of Judah, Jesus' ancestors, but when they were sculpted in the 13th century, people didn't really have any idea of historical exactitude, so they didn't know what the kings of Judah had looked like. They made them look like the contemporary kings of France that they knew, and after a while it was forgotten exactly who they were, and they were taken to be the kings of France.
Are we essentially looking at what 13th century family would have seen?
No, because they would have been brightly coloured, many different colours and a gold background.
And that was perfectly normal for the time?
Yes, that would have been quite normal for the statues to be painted like this, yes. Quite lifelike, in fact.
So, Oriel, we're going to go and look at the central portal.
This is probably the most important one because this is where the bishops will have entered the church, but there are, in fact, 3, and they represent the Trinity. Everything is symbolic in the church.
Okay, so this one we're looking at, this is the main one, where the bishops entered, as you said. What is represented here? These sculptures are extraordinary.
Well, this one shows the Last Judgment. We've got 3 levels, and on the bottom level, on either side, there are angels blowing their trumpets and people coming out of their tombs.
So that's above these two huge wooden doors?
Yes. And then on the line above is St. Michael the Archangel holding scales, so he's weighing the souls to see who's suitable to go to heaven and who has to go to hell. And you can see they're divided into 2 sides, on one side going off in chains, and on the other side they've got crowns on their heads. In fact, if you look second from the right, you've got a big grinning devil there, and if you look at the headdresses of the people he's sitting on, you can see one is a king and one is a bishop, and I think that was to remind them that judgment was for everybody.
So bishops and kings can also go to hell?
Yes, I should think that the ordinary people were quite thankful of this.
Well, we've just left the Last Judgment portal and we've entered the cathedral. We're in the nave, that's the long main body of the church, and further up, towards the back end of the church, are the transepts, the structure that crosses the nave, forming the cathedral into a cross. The light here is really soft. It's filtered by the multicoloured stained glass of the arch windows, which line the length of the cathedral. On each side of the nave are arched entrances that go into chapels that were funded by 13th century canons who were hoping to donate their way into a place in heaven. The many changes made to Notre Dame in the mid to late 13th century are ascribed to the architects Jean de Chelles and Pierre de Montreuil. But over the centuries, the cathedral has gone through a process of almost constant alteration, each according to the fashion of the time. No doubt you can hear the choir practicing here, and we're now crossing the transepts towards where they sit.
Oriol, we're standing here, we're in fact in the choir, and the chairs here, these long wooden ornately carved benches, now what period would they stem from?
They date from the 18th century, and these were the seats for the monks. In fact, you can see that there's a little flap here that flaps up, and this is called a misericord, which means mercy. It was a mercy seat for these poor monks who had to stand for many long hours for the services, and they could rest their bottoms on these little seats, and so they've been sculpted underneath. And generally the sculptures show ordinary scenes of ordinary life, because you couldn't really have a religious scene for the monk to sit on.
And standing here where we are in the choir, you can really appreciate the work on the stained glass windows.
Yes, and the stained glass window that we're looking at here, which is the western rose window, is some of the original stained glass that dates from the 13th century, and it's got a particularly deep quality to it. It looks almost like purple, though in fact, if you look carefully at it, it's red and blue that fuses together in your eye.
Well, we're now going into the treasury, just right of the choir, and it's here where the church keeps its relics, bones and artifacts said to have belonged to saints and holy figures. And though Notre Dame was never on the top of the list of medieval pilgrims who adhered to the cult of relics, it has quite a selection.
A little jar of milk purported to come from the breast of the Virgin Mary, some wood from the True Cross, and even the real feathers from the wings of the Archangel Gabriel. And it was believed, and still is in medieval times, that a saint could intercede to earthly beings via his own relics. It meant that if your church owned a toenail or a finger bone of a certain saint, you had a direct line to that saint. You could get in touch with him.
It seems to me to be all rather gruesome, really, these various bits of people's bodies. But it was big business. I mean, around the 12th century, relics were big business.
Well, I think so, yes, because if your church owned an important relic, people would come from miles to see it. So it meant that pilgrims would be coming to your town, spending lots of money, staying in your hotels and inns, and wearing out their shoes, walking to your town, so they'd be making the shoemakers rich. And I think that a lot of relics were probably stolen, pinched and purloined. And there was probably quite a black market for good relics as well.
Who would authenticate the relics?
Each church, important church, would have its own authenticator of relics, who would be a historian amongst the monks of the church.
He would have to decide whether it was genuine or not.
Yes, I think he would have to decide whether it was genuine or not. And from that moment onwards, the relic could either be kept by the church or probably became a marketable object, a good piece of merchandise.
One relic here in the treasury is said to be authentic. It's the crown of thorns, or what is said to be the crown of thorns, and which apparently can be authenticated. Well, I'm with François Girard, who's the intendant, the chief administrator here at Notre Dame. Mr. Girard, this is what's said to be the crown of thorns that Jesus actually wore on the cross.
Yes, it's the major relic. In fact, the only one to which we devote some sort of worship on Good Friday. The crown of thorns sprung up in the 1238 when it became known to Louis IX, King of France, that the Venetians, who had bought it from the Emperor of Byzantium, were trying to get rid of it. So St. Louis bought it from the Venetians and brought it to Paris, first to Notre Dame, then to the Sainte-Chapelle, a very beautiful Gothic chapel which he had built especially for the Crown of Thorns. It stayed there until the Revolution, when it was taken away to the Bibliothèque Nationale, and Napoleon I had it brought to Notre Dame rather than to the Sainte-Chapelle. But in fact, the Crown of Thorns is in a safe kept away, and it's only taken out on Good Friday, where it's being venerated all day by the faithful.
Well, when King Louis bought the Crown of Thorns, he obviously believed very much in its authenticity. How do you authenticate something like that?
Well, it's being traced in history down to St. Paulin of Nol, who spoke about it in a text written in the 5th century. And it is known that it was kept at the Imperial Palace in Constantinople. So there is a fair chance of it being really the Crown of Thorns. Tests have been made, and it's definitely made out of weeds that do grow in Palestine. It's been also tested with carbon-14, and it does go back something like 19th centuries. We can't say anymore, but considering the number of people who have come to worship Christ apropos his crown, let's say that he's been awaited with the prayers of thousands.
We're now in the main body of the church.
In the choir.
Just heading for the choir, and we're just above the transepts. At the moment, we're surrounded by people who are looking at the church as tourists. I can't see anybody near us immediately who appears to be worshipping. What does tourism mean for Notre Dame at the moment?
Well, it means an income without which we couldn't keep up the place.
But you're not always altogether happy with the number of tourists who come here, approximately 12 to 13 million per year who pass through the doors here.
Yes, and it's at times intolerable. When you have up to 20, 25 groups of 30 to 40 tourists crowding around their guide, and maybe 10 of these groups looking at the same rose window, and two of them speak Spanish, three are speaking English, two are speaking Japanese, and they're just trying to outvoice each other, it's just intolerable. But Notre Dame is a historic monument, and it's open to the public.
In the Middle Ages, I imagine the church was equally busy. And were all the people flowing through the doors then, coming to worship?
In fact, there was already at the time a conflict between the canons, who had their daily services in the cathedral, and the corporations, we would now call them unions or syndicates, did set up their own little chapels where they met to pray together, but also to discuss their little businesses.
And they were the guilds of the time, like the goldsmiths or whatever.
Yeah, you had the guild of the goldsmiths, that of the carpenters, that of the embroiderers or whatever. And when a dozen of them were meeting at the same time, it probably did create some havoc. But at the time also, the state, the city, the church were roughly one thing, so intermixed that it was quite natural when the king summoned the états généraux, which we could say parliament, he had them meeting in the cathedral because it was the biggest building available. It's in the heart of the city, and the king's palace wasn't very far away, so it was a convenient place to meet.
But the guilds and parliament would have been the least of it. In the 12th and 13th centuries, Notre Dame was central to the life of the city. And here, under the high-vaulted roof of the nave, merchants and money changers would have made deals. Ordinary people would have congregated, and the poor are known to have been allowed to sleep in the cathedral. After all, in the Middle Ages, it would have been one of the few relatively warm places within the nearby walls of Paris. And in one of the chapels, towards the back of Notre Dame, abandoned babies and children were left to the mercy of the church. Today, perhaps, Notre Dame's a comparatively quiet place.
And now we're heading up to see one of the other big attractions here at Notre Dame, which is the bell. And we're climbing up these stone stairs. This is all stone. It's a spiral, a staircase that spirals on itself. And this was all already in place in the late 12th century. So medieval feet would have trod these stairs as well. So I've just come out of the right-hand side of the church, and we're probably about 10 stories up here. This is the top of the second level, really, of the cathedral.
Yes, I think you're right. It's about 10 stories above Paris up here, and we're two-thirds of the way up the front of the cathedral. The facade is divided into three different levels, really. There's the portal level, there's the rose window level, and here we're at the base of the bell towers.
We're looking out over Paris. It's the most extraordinary view from here.
It is, isn't it? Straight in front of us, you can see the River Seine, which is cutting Paris in half. Up to your right-hand side on the north, you've got Sacré-Cœur on top of its hill, and the new modern district of La Défense in the west of Paris, and of course the Eiffel Tower. There, a marvellous view of the Eiffel.
So we're now just stooping down to enter into what's the actual tower of the Grand Bell. And now we're going up yet another stairway, this time wooden. It's the structure in here is entirely wooden. We're now looking at the Grand Bell, the Great Bell, Bourdon, it's called. It's from the 17th century.
That's right. In fact, originally there was a bell here in 1400, and then in the 17th century they melted it down and made it larger. That was during the reign of Louis the 14th. They renamed the bell Emmanuel, so that's its name. And the bell is made of bronze.
It looks like a rather murky, dark metal to me.
Yes, with a lot of pigeon droppings on it as well, I'm afraid, yes. But it is, in fact, bronze, and that gives the most beautiful sound. And when it was melted down, a lot of people came with their jewellery, gold and silver jewellery, which was thrown into the molten metal because it was felt that this gave a silvery sound. In fact, it changes, doesn't change the sound whatsoever, but people like to donate their jewellery for this.
Ah, and I think we're just going to hear the bell rang. There's a guide here. Middle Ages fell away, so the fortunes of Notre Dame changed. By the 1700s, the Gothic style of architecture was long out of favour, and the cathedral was rather neglected. By the late 1700s, French history almost caused the destruction of the entire church. The French Revolution was the one event that most scarred Notre Dame. When the revolution erupted, the church was hated almost as much as royalty, and the revolutionaries sought to destroy what they saw as symbols of the church's repression. In Paris, the most visible symbol was here, Notre Dame. The mob clambered up the facade of the cathedral on scaffolding, dislodging and destroying many of the statues and sculptures, and the cathedral was badly defaced. And in the heat of the revolution, it wasn't only the edifice of the church that suffered.
The intellectuals of the revolution decided to venerate the cult of the goddess Reason. And in order to do this, they needed the same sort of regalia that the Catholic religion had had, which meant bringing in people and colour and characters and equipment. And the goddess Reason became, in fact, a dancer from the Opera of Paris, a young Mademoiselle Maillard, who was brought into the church and dressed up in a white flowing tunic, given a sort of long blonde hairstyle that was covered up with a red Frisian bonnet, which is a sort of revolutionary hat. So you must imagine, here we are in the nave of the cathedral. It would have looked extremely different in those days, because Mademoiselle Maillard in her costume would have led a very complicated procession, accompanied by the rest of the chorus of the ballet of the opera, joining in this very elaborate service. And painted on the front of the church in large gold letters was the Temple of Reason.
So instead, perhaps, of all these religious paintings that we see here in the chapels all along the side of the nave, we might have had the bleu, blanc, rouge, the red, white and blue flag of the revolutionaries, now the French flag, hung all over the cathedral.
You'd have had the red, white and blue, the cocarde, the revolutionary rosette, ivy and mistletoe, and anything else that conjured up the idea of a pagan religion, anything that would have offended the Catholic religion that had previously been celebrated here at Notre Dame.
It was not until well into the 19th century that the fortunes of Notre Dame rose again. And the change in attitude was largely due to Victor Hugo's novel, Notre Dame of Paris. Through the hunchback Quasimodo and other characters, Hugo presents a romantic picture of Notre Dame in the late Middle Ages, and he attacked those who allowed the decline of the church.
The Church of Notre Dame of Paris is, without doubt, even today, a sublime and majestic building. But however much it may have conserved its beauty as it has grown older, it is not hard to regret, not to feel indignation at the numberless degradations and mutilations which time and men have wrought simultaneously on this venerable monument.
Hugo's great historical novel was a bestseller, and it also sparked a revival in Gothic architecture and the romantic image of France's medieval heritage.
It was really at the publication of this book in 1831 that people became interested in the church and became worried that it was in a terrible state of disrepair. And so a petition was launched, many famous people signed it, and at that time they organised a competition to restore the church. And that's when Viollet-le-Duc was chosen. He, along with his colleague Lassus, spent 20 years restoring the church, and a lot of what we look at today is actually their work.
It's doubtful that the first unknown architect of Notre Dame would have dreamed that his grand project would still be standing 8 centuries after his death. And for all we know, Notre Dame may still be standing and living 8 centuries from today.